So if Ulysses is the prose Everest of our studies, then I suppose A Wasteland is the poetry equivalent. If you're thinking about texts which exemplify what modernism is and kind of epitomise the idea of modernism, then you could do a lot worse than choosing things published in 1922. Ulysses by Joyce and The Wasteland by Eliot. So we're putting some emphasis, just as we put some emphasis on Ulysses by using the discussion thread, we're putting emphasis on The Wasteland by making it the focus of one of the assignments. You've got a choice between Wasteland or Catherine Mansfield. And clearly you can also write about The Wasteland in the major longer assignment that comes later. So we've got two lectures and 2 weeks worth of study on The Wasteland. We're going to be scratching the surface, I think it has to be said. There's an awful lot you could go into. Luckily for you, there's an enormous critical bibliography on The Wasteland. It's huge. So, there is plenty of secondary material for you to get your teeth into. So what I'm going to do is a sort of overview today of the structure of the poem. I want to say something about the themes, and I want to say something about the technique. And then next week we'll go into more detail about specific aspects of The Wasteland. So it's published in 1922. Eliot had published poems before. This was his first major long poem to be published, and it is partly the result of a series of events in his life. I don't want to get too much into Eliot's biography, but it's clear that he had some kind of mental breakdown, and that at least part of The Wasteland was written almost as a kind of cathartic exercise to get out of that mental breakdown. He produced a very long, rambling poem, which he showed to Ezra Pound, and Ezra Pound set to work with a vengeance on editing it. So when you see the dedication of The Wasteland, it says for Ezra Pound, il miglior fabbro, in other words, the better craftsman, which means, which is an acknowledgement, I think, of Pound's hand in The Wasteland. There's a fascinating facsimile publication, there's a copy in the library, of The Wasteland with Eliot, with Pound's revisions. And you can see how whole passages have been taken out and things have been rearranged. It's very, very instructive. Eliot's, of course, like Pound, American, but with a very European sensibility, studied at Harvard, I think at Harvard, maybe Princeton, studied at a major American university anyway, and then came to Europe for more study and to work and to live. So, and actually towards the end of his life became an English citizen. So we kind of claim him as English. Sorry to the Americans in the audience. So at the time he's publishing The Wasteland, he's not really established as a full-time poet, as it were. He's got a job in a bank, Lloyd's Bank, in fact, in London, and he uses that experience to some extent. There's a passage in The Wasteland where he talks about all the people going over London Bridge to trudge wearily into their offices in the city, which, of course, he would have been used to. So The Wasteland is an extraordinary thing. And the first thing I want to do is to... if this works, to give you a little flavour of Eliot reading the opening.
April is the greatest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm, covering earth in forgetful snow, feet. a little life with dried tubers. Summer surprised us, coming over the Starnberger See with a shower of rain. We stopped in the colonnade and went on in sunlight into the Hofgarten and drank coffee and talked for an hour. Bin gar keine Russin, stamm aus Litauen, echt Deutsch. And when we were children, staying at the Archduke's, my cousin's, he took me out on a sled and I was frightened. He said, Marie, Marie, hold on tight. And down we went. In the mountains, there you feel free. I read much of the night and go south in the winter.
Right, I won't subject you to any more of that because, I mean, I think you'll notice a couple of things about Eliot's reading of his poem. And I think possibly the first thing you think is what a terrible reader of his own poetry Eliot is. He has this very kind of monotonous tone. He doesn't vary very much in terms of the way he's expressing himself. And, you know, there's another 25 minutes of that if you're keen. Maybe if you've got insomnia, it might be a good listen. So that's one thing you might consider about Eliot's reading of that. The other thing is that's the opening of this poem, and immediately I think there are a few things which are striking to the reader. The first, perhaps, is that there doesn't seem to be any obvious rhythmic pattern or rhyme scheme or metrical pattern. You will, as you go through the wasteland, discover that there are passages which do conform to particular types of and are susceptible to metrical analysis. But this is an example of what Eliot called vers libre, free verse, where the unit of construction is the line, and the line is as long as it needs to be in order to express the sentiment. So it's not... I think it's worth pointing out that people like Eliot and Pound, who are exponents of free verse, are not abandoning the idea of the musicality of language. They're not abandoning rhythm. They're not even abandoning rhyme, because you will find some rhyming there. But they're not tied to particular metrical structural patterns. And that gives them the freedom to express themselves like this. A couple of other things that you might notice, that there's a bit of German in there, which is pretty standard for Eliot, and particularly in the Wasteland, you'll find bits of German, you'll find bits of Italian, you'll find bits of French, you'll find one or two other languages too, Sanskrit, for example, and they're included in the poem without, you know, apology, without translation. They're part of his poetic expression. One other thing that you might notice, there's lots of things to notice in that opening passage. One of the other things you might notice is that we're at the beginning of what, you know, we might imagine to be a fairly lengthy narrative poem, and we might be used to poems of this sort of length that tell a story. So, you know, I'm thinking of something like maybe The Ancient Mariner by Coleridge, something like that. In those sorts of poems, though, you've got a very definite structure, you've got a very definite narrative which is to be conveyed. Here, you might be thinking after that first section, the first 20 lines or so, you might be thinking, this is going to be about a character called Marie. She's looking back to her childhood. There's a passage there around about line 15. When we were children, staying at the Archduke's, my cousins, he took me out on a sled and I was frightened. He said, Marie, Marie, hold on tight, and down we went. So you might be thinking, so this is going to be the childhood reminiscences of Marie. What do we know about Marie? Well, her cousin is the Archduke, so she's kind of aristocracy. maybe European aristocracy, judging from some of the stuff that comes before that. But actually, no, because that passage where I stopped Eliot's reading just now, that passage stopped, and then we get a different voice coming in. So one of the things that you notice very quickly about The Wasteland is the multiplicity of voices. There are many narrators, many narrative voices. One critic who I thought sort of said something that was not exactly profound, but a useful way of thinking about The Wasteland, it seems to me, is that if you imagine, and Eliot does at one point in the poem, the old-fashioned fogs that used to engulf London because of the heavy industry and so on, and so you know you'd get these fogs where you couldn't really see in front of your nose. Imagine a London fog like that, and imagine the voices that you hear if you're out on the streets. You know, they come from nowhere and they pass, and you hear little snatches of conversation, little bits of speech. The Wasteland is a bit like that. All of these voices, which fleetingly appear and take your attention and then disappear. And they might reappear later on, or they might not. So we're not looking at a poem which has a narrative structure in terms of beginning, middle, and end. We're not moving from an idea of, if we go back to the Ancient Mariner, you know, he's got a story to tell, and he starts in kind of once upon a time fashion and then takes you through the story. It isn't like that. But I think we do have a structure, and we can say something about it. Eliot divides a poem into five parts. And I think as soon as you do that in a work of literature, as soon as you present something in five parts, it's going to recall the classic five-part structure of Renaissance drama that we're used to when we're looking at Shakespeare and his contemporaries. And of course, that five-part structure in itself derives from Aristotle's idea of how a play should be structured and the idea of the dramatic unities. So the structure in Renaissance drama would be you have an introduction, you have a development, there's some sort of crisis, there's an elaboration of that crisis, and there's a resolution. They are the five parts of you know, a Shakespeare play or a Ben Jonson play, Marston, all of those guys from the Renaissance. If they are trying to observe Aristotle's unities, then the play will take place in real time. It will have unity of time, have unity of place, it will have unity of character. A lot of Renaissance drama doesn't do that, actually. But, you know, it seems to me, without making too much of a fuss about it, choosing to have five parts at least is a gesture towards that kind of structure. But having said that, the structure was heavily altered by Pound. So, for example, part four, which is very short, it's only a few lines, 10 or 12 lines long, and is easily the shortest section, used to be a lot longer. Used to, in fact, be 90% longer, and that's been lost in the final poem, because Pound cut it. So there are questions to be asked about how the poem is structured and how the poem hangs together. One of the key questions, I think, that you need to ask yourself when you look at The Wasteland is it a kind of organic whole, or is it really just a collection of snippets, a kind of collage? Does it actually hang together? Quite a few critics suggest it does. So here's one approach to the structure, which thinks of the poem as a kind of journey. And that's significant, I think, because one of the key motifs in the poem is the Grail legend, which of course is one of the classic narrative quest or journey narratives. And so looking at the poem as a kind of spiritual or mental journey might be fruitful. And this is what one critic called Elisa May Sparks, and the reference is on the PowerPoint slide if you look at it on Blackboard. This is what she suggests. So we've had the burial of the dead, the first bit that we heard the beginning of a minute ago, which she describes as asking the question, starting the journey. So that, you know, this is the introductory bit in Renaissance drama terms. A game of chess, the second part, she suggests, is about an incomplete answer. You know, if this is a quest, there's people are trying to find the answer and they're not finding it here, and it's all very frustrating. In the third section, you get called the fire sermon, another unsatisfactory answer, and some sort of crisis as well, I think I would argue, in that passage, if we relate it to Renaissance drama again. The fourth section, Death by Water, is the idea of reaching the bottom of something, the nadir. Sparagmos is this Greek idea of the sacrifice of a living thing. So Death by Water is about death, and it's about kind of sacrificing to the gods in order for what to happen? Well, usually in order to regenerate life. And so then in the fifth section, what the thunder said, the possibility of some kind of answer. Now, one of the things that you might notice about this is that it's all very provisional. It's, you know, this critic is not suggesting, you know, this is a definite structure. It's not susceptible to the kind of analysis that you might do of other sorts of narrative verse. And, you know, I would suggest it's not really narrative in that sense. But what it does suggest is that you can think of ways in which you look at the structure and you can discern some kind of progression through either, you know, the events that are described there, or you can think of it thematically. And one very simple thematic way of looking at it is to think of it as dealing with the elements. And in the same way that Ulysses has its emphasis on particular ideas and particular concepts in each chapter, you could argue that the five parts of the wasteland deal, one way or another, with these sorts of things. Earth, the burial of the dead, the first section. The third section, the fire sermon. The fourth section, death by water. You know, there are obvious hints as to the elements that are being discussed there. And I'm not suggesting that either of these two ways are the right way. What I am suggesting is that there are ways into the study of the wasteland that might help you in terms of thinking of it thematically, thinking of it structurally. You know, there are ways in. I don't think you need to kind of throw your hands up and say, oh, you know, I can't possibly understand this. It is understandable. It is graspable, I think, but you need a method. Okay. So I'm just going to say a little bit more about the structure, because it seems to me that the structure will link to the themes. And if we think about the themes for a moment, this is a long poem which doesn't seem to have a kind of unified narrative to it, but nonetheless keeps obsessively coming back to the same images, the same motifs that crop up over and over again. So we have very frequently the idea of a quest for, well, at times it's explicit, you know, a kind of grail type quest, but a quest for something, something that's out of reach. People are searching for something and they can't quite grasp it. And it's often expressed using a lot of the images and ideas from the Grail legend, and then going back further into ancient myth and ritual to describe what's going on. So here's a bit... I've missed a page there. That's kind of just what I was saying. The idea that the narrative isn't linear, right? So it doesn't move from beginning, middle to end in the usual way. That if you're looking for some sort of unification, then we're thinking about symbols, we're thinking about allusions, we're thinking about references, those kinds of things. So it's a kind of collage effect or a mosaic effect, if you like. One suggestion is it might be cinematic. Eliot's writing at the beginning of the film age. So you could argue that he's taking some of the ideas that cinema is coming up with in terms of how it tells a story. You know, that idea of cutting from one scene to another in cinema is just being established. We don't have any problem with it at all. We understand the grammar of cinema or TV, so we understand that if we're shown one scene and then we cut to a completely different place, we're not looking at the screen and thinking, what's happened there? You know, what happened to those people in the first scene? We understand that there is some kind of relationship, and that will become clear. So you could argue that the poem works in a similar way. So just picking up on those ideas of legend and ritual. This is a quotation from Fraser's The Golden Bough. Now Fraser, James Fraser, Sir James Fraser, was, if you've read Middlemarch, then you'll know one of the central characters in Middlemarch wants to write the key to all mythologies. It's his life's work, and he's never going to achieve it. James Fraser was a similar kind of character, really. He wrote this huge multi-volume book, which is about mythologies from all over the world, and he tried to find connections and succeeded in finding lots of connections between them. This book was called The Golden Bough, and it was very popular in the early years of the 20th century. It was read by a lot of modernists, including Eliot. And he says, actually, in his notes to The Wasteland, that he was heavily influenced by The Golden Bough. So this is what Fraser has to say about the seasons and the interaction between the ideas that the primitive people had about the seasons and how that translated into sort of religious belief and ritual. What he suggests then is that although men, people, I think we would say, now attributed the annual cycle of change primarily to corresponding changes in their deities, you know, so whoever you worship, you know, controls the weather, we're used to that idea, they still thought that by performing certain magical rites they could aid the god, who was the principle of life, in his struggle with the opposing principle of death. So it's this endless cycle of death and renewal, and the rituals that are associated with it, that is at the heart of, for Fraser, a lot of primitive belief, and that translates then into the kind of legends which come with more advanced civilizations later on. And those advanced civilizations tend to come up with stories like the medieval romances of the Grail. And this is Jesse Weston. And Jesse Weston is also credited by Eliot as being influential. She wrote a book called From Ritual to Romance. And by ritual, she means the ancient rituals of primitive peoples, kind of, you know, things that happened at, say, Stonehenge, places like that. And how that translates into romance, by which she means medieval romance. She means that the kind of chivalric romances of France and Germany and to some extent England in the Middle Ages. And she looks at, for example, some of the Grail romances and looks at Gawain. And what she identifies there is this idea of a wasteland, which can only be which can only be reawoken by certain mysterious discoveries. And she links that with those kind of rituals and sacrifices that ancient peoples would have made in order to appease the gods who were going to, you know, produce fruitfulness in the following year. So, you know, she makes that sort of connection. So the object of the rites is the restoration of vegetation connected with the revival of the god. The object of the quest is the same, but connected with the restoration to health of the king. So you've got this idea of the archetypal narrative, if you like, of those rituals from the past being translated into something a bit more literary, a bit more cultural in the Middle Ages. One of the characters that she identifies, and this is one of the characters that Eliot picks up on, is the Fisher King. Jesse Weston says the Fisher King is derived from pagan fertility rituals. And she sees in the development of numerous legends, you know, in the roots of them, this idea of the Fisher King. And this is backed up by other researchers too. So this is a 19th century German writer called Heinzel. Identifies the Fisher King as the keeper of the Holy Grail. And so what that does is make a link between the ancient ritual from the primitive people to the medieval romance to the idea of Christianity and the iconography of Christianity. So that's a, you know, those are the kind of background background knowledge that Eliot's expecting you to have. And one of the, it's not one of the problems really, but one of the challenges, you might say, of reading The Wasteland is that you're dealing with an author who is deeply embedded in the study of European culture, who has studied Dante, has studied Goethe, is fluent in several languages, and wears that learning openly, if you like, on the page. So, ideally then, you would need to know several languages and all the rest of it, and we don't. So The Wasteland is one of those poems where you need the notes, you know, you need good, authoritative notes. Eliot actually produced some notes, which in most editions you'll find printed with The Wasteland. He was a bit reluctant to do so. He thought it was a bit of a joke, actually, when people said to him, well, you know, people aren't going to understand this, Tom. Can we have a few notes? And he kind of produced a few notes, but most of them just said, oh, well, you know, see this or see the other. And he's just naming the source text. Occasionally, he goes into a bit more detail, particularly about Jesse Weston. But anyway, that's from Heitzel's The Alte Französische Glaubensromanen, which, of course, will be on everybody's bedside table. Right, so if we think about the themes then, we've got this kind of Arthurian theme. So this is why I want to mention R.S. Loomis here. Loomis is the Arthurian critic. You know, he's the man, the go-to man, if you want to know about Arthurian legend. And he identifies this this strain in the Grail legend to do with the wounded king and the fact that, you know, there seems to be almost a paradox here. There was a wounded king for the hero to cure. There was a slain king for him to avenge. Yet they seem to bear somewhat the same name. This is the Fisher King. The king's infirmity or death caused his land to be sterile and waste. Yet strange to say, he possessed the talisman of inexhaustible abundance. The talisman being the Grail. So, you know, there's this paradox at the heart of these legends, which, you know, you're never going to unravel. I don't think anybody does. But what it provides for Eliot, I think, is a very powerful source of imagery and mythology on which to draw, and which to draw parallels to modern life as well. So, you know, the idea, you can imagine that the idea of a wasteland, an idea where energy has been drained from a whole country, a whole landscape, is actually quite a powerful one to think about in the years immediately after the First World War, when we've actually seen that kind of thing enacted physically. So that's why I want to go on to say, well, how does this fit 1922? It's all very well going on about these medieval romances and these ancient rituals and so on. What's that got to do with modernism, the 20th century, 1922? So that's what I want to say something about now. Are we all right so far? Yep. Good. It's knotty stuff, this. You know, it is difficult, but I think very rewarding once you engage with it. So, as I say, this is post-war. This is... Eliot begins writing this around about 1920, we think. So, not long after the end of the First World War in November 1918. And, you know, we've said this before, but it's perhaps worth reiterating. The First World War is a cataclysmic event in European culture for all kinds of reasons. I mean, the first is the sheer scale of deaths and injury that's sustained. You know, millions of people, largely men, of course, died in those horrible trenches in Flanders and France and so on. Unbelievable suffering, unbelievable carnage on a scale that had never been seen before. And people found it very difficult to get their heads around. You know, this was extraordinary. The mechanisation of war as well, the fact that this is a war where tanks were used for the first time, planes were used for the first time, very heavy guns, machine guns and so on. The idea of war as a kind of system for processing death almost is there. The other thing, of course, that the war does is it redraws the map of Europe. So in the settlement after the war, empires disappear. You know, the Ottoman Empire, gone. The Austro-Hungarian Empire, gone. Other countries have different political systems set up as a result of the war. So, and the borders of countries change. It's very instructive. If you look at the borders of Poland through the 20th century, you know, it's all over the place. It moves about Europe. Because of the First World War and the Second World War. So this, you know, the impact is difficult to imagine, really. So not just is your concept of what war is, your concept of how nations relate to each other has changed, but actually a lot of the old structure, the old familiar structure of 19th century Europe with its nation states, its little empires, its dukedoms, etc., etc., all swept away in these four terrible years. So people looking at Europe at the end of the First World War are seeing something which is utterly different from the world that existed 4 years before. You know, it's the landscape has completely changed. And I mean landscape in the physical sense as well as in the metaphorical sense. So that's a strong impulse, I think, for Eliot. As I mentioned before, it's a time of personal crisis for him. And a lot of people, including Eliot, saw the First World War as a kind of awful warning about the decline of civilization, and this sense of impending doom, of catastrophe, seem to hang over everything. So you get quite a few people at this time writing about how civilization, by which they mean, you know, the kind of cultural element of society, is under threat. And, you know, the things that people have valued are no longer being valued. It's also seen perhaps in the debasement of personal relationships and the breakdown of some of the old authorities there, particularly religion. So you've also got a kind of crisis of faith going on. So all of these things coming together to form a kind of vortex of problems, and those are being reflected and refracted through Eliot's poem. So that's, you know, that's the kind of mental landscape that Eliot's dealing with here, I think. I want to say a little bit about his technique. And I suppose the most startling thing about Eliot's technique is the deliberate use of what we might call precursor texts. So he takes passages from things that already exist, and he juxtaposes them with things that he's invented. And, you know, you could argue that he's stealing these things. And in fact, he would probably agree. There's a line of Eliot's where he says something like, I'm paraphrasing, but he says something like, mediocre poets borrow, great poets steal. And certainly he does steal. You know, so there are direct quotations from Shakespeare, Dante, Wagner's operas, all kinds of things deliberately put into his work. And they're there for, well, they're there for all kinds of reasons, and those are the kinds of things we can discuss in class. But one of the obvious things that they do is that they're juxtaposed with the images that he's producing. So, for example, if we think about the opening of the Fire Sermon, which borrows from one of Spenser's poems, and it's about the Thames. Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song. In that passage, what Eliot does very effectively, I think, is contrast this vision of, and it's an impossible vision actually, of a pastoral London where nymphs and shepherds dance around in the grass and celebrate somebody's marriage, and everything is very, very lovely. It's a rural idyll. Compares that kind of pastoral scene with the present day 1922 version of London with rubbish strewn on the bank and oil clogging up the Thames itself and so on. So it's very... it's very much used like that throughout the poem to highlight the difference between an idealized past and, you know, a very kind of sordid present. Just to move on a bit from there, the idea of fragmentation is very, very important in the poem. The poem doesn't seem to move very logically, and sometimes even the syntax, individual lines break down. So, for example, at the end of the Fire Sermon, you've got this idea of burning, and it's a reference to the sack of Carthage in Roman times. But it's almost as if it's consumed the page itself, and you get this white space and just the words burning almost randomly placed there on the page. So the poem is kind of enacting that idea of fragmentation. So why does it do that is a question that you need to ask. But one of the things that I would suggest is that Eliot is presenting a vision of the world in which communication becomes more and more difficult because people are isolated, alienated, they can't communicate with each other. And so this poem enacts that difficulty. At the end of the poem, those two techniques of using precursor text and the idea of fragmentation comes together, and you get 10 lines at the end of the poem. Which start with, I sat upon the shore fishing with the arid plains behind me, reference to the Fisher King. And then you get ten lines or so where each line is stolen from somewhere or another. They're in different languages. And it finishes, actually interestingly, finishes on line 430 with, "These fragments I have shored against my ruins." And "these fragments I have shored against my ruins" is the only bit in that section which doesn't seem to come from somewhere else. And that seems to be a statement of what Eliot is about here. "These fragments I have shored against my ruins." So the fragmentary nature of this text that we have in front of us is some kind of desperate effort to shore up civilization against the ravages which are currently upon it. So it's almost like a sort of Tower of Babel at the end of the poem there. There's quotations within that section and elsewhere in the poem where the quotations are either kind of straight, if you like, they're just presented baldly on the page, or more often they're submerged, they're mangled, they're defamiliarized. Things are changed within them, you know, to make a different sort of point. And obviously that draws attention to them. So I think it's crucial when you're looking at the poem and you see, and you know, the notes will tell you if you don't recognise it yourself, you'll see where Eliot has used a quotation from a precursor text. But what's he done with it? You know, how has he changed it? What effect does that change have? What's he saying about present-day society that's illuminated by that quotation? So, you know, you could start at the beginning. "April is the cruelest month," the first line of the poem, which is a bit startling. Why is April the cruelest month? April is nearly always associated with good things. It's a time of spring, it's a time of growth, it's a time of greenery, green shoots, all of those sort of good things that we associate. But it's the cruelest month here. So there's a deliberate change there in the kind of atmosphere that you might expect when you get April as a beginning. Of course, April, I think a lot of people would recognise that, you know, the opening line of a long poem that uses April, the prologue to the Canterbury Tales, and people often juxtapose that with the wasteland. A bit later on, Eliot uses the line, "But at my back I always hear," which is a lift from Marvell's "To His Coy Mistress." You remember that? "But at my back I always hear time's winged chariot hurrying near." You know, that idea of death being ever present. And, you know, Marvell's poem is all about enjoying yourself while you can, because, you know, tomorrow you may die. And Eliot has the ability, I think, and has the opportunity, by using phrases like that, to import. Well, this is the thing about intertextuality, isn't it? You import the previous text, you import the meanings that that text has, and because of how you use it and you juxtapose it in your work, you give it extra meaning. You give it perhaps some ironic meaning, or, you know, you take it off at a different tangent. So you get a kind of two-for-one effect. You've got the meanings that the words had in the previous text, but you've also got them developed in your text as well. And that's something that he does a lot in the poem. Having said all that, this sounds all very radical, but there are still some traditional elements. If you analyse the opening passage carefully enough, you'll see that there's actually some regularity about it. And you know, you can do kind of syllable counts and see that there is something regular about it. In the scene in the second part, featuring the typist and the clerk, rather sordid sexual encounter, there's a submerged sonnet in there. You know, absolutely kind of regular sonnet form. So, you know, there are those kind of traditional elements in there too. The idea of motifs and images which recur, obviously a sort of standard technique in poetry, is there throughout as well. So we have things like the Fisher King, we have things like the Unreal City, which keep cropping up in the poem. So, to conclude, what we have here, I think, is something that's very complex. It's about spiritual and moral decay. It's set within the context of a sense of nostalgic longing for a lost golden age, but at the same time, and I think this is important to mention, a recognition that that lost golden age was never really a lost golden age. So that the representatives of that lost golden age are actually presented in a context which suggests that the speaker or the author doesn't actually buy into that idea. So it's not about, things were much better in the past and now they're rubbish. There is an element of that, but there's also a more sophisticated realisation that what people said about the past is inevitably seen through rose-coloured glasses. You know, it's that kind of hindsight, everything was great back then. And of course this is a motif that runs right the way through literature. You can go back to Virgil, writing in the 2nd century. He's going on about how things were much better in the past. It's a standard trope of literature, you know, this idea of the golden age that's gone. There seems to be also the motif of self-disgust and self-pity. Speakers within the poem are, lacking that kind of confidence that they might have in an age which is more sure of itself. This is an age which isn't sure of itself. People don't have a sense of identity, don't have a sense of who they are, and that comes out very clearly. And the idea of things breaking down in the wasteland, things don't work, connections aren't made. The world is broken, and that breakdown is figured in the language of the poem. So we have a poem which is in fragments. These fragments I will shore against my ruins, says the speaker at the end. So this is a kind of poem that we've got here. So very complex, very challenging, but very rewarding too. Okay, so I'll stop there. Thanks for your attention, and see you shortly. Thank you.